If only life had a remote control, you could pause or rewind. Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. Take the 1-minute risk test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its prediabetes awareness partners.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
President Biden's cabinet picks begin running into some trouble in the Senate. Plus, the Supreme Court declines to hear a case on Pennsylvania's election rules last year. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleagues, WSJ columnists Kim Strassel and Bill McGurn. Up till now, so far, Joe Biden's cabinet nominees have mostly had smooth sailing in the Senate. On Tuesday, there were two bipartisan confirmations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield as ambassador to the United Nations and Tom Vilsack as agriculture secretary. Those votes were 78 to 20 and 92 to 7. Merrick Garland, the attorney general nominee, looks like he'll be confirmed. And the closest vote on any of these nominees to date has been on the Secretary of Homeland Security, which was a 56 to 43 vote. So 6 votes to spare there in a divided Senate. And the first question I have, Bill, is I went back and looked at some of the numbers from President Trump's confirmations, and they look a lot closer. I mean, Rex Tillerson got 56 votes. Steve Mnuchin got 53. Jeff Sessions and Tom Price got 52. Mick Mulvaney got 51. And then, of course, Betsy DeVos, the education secretary, it was a 50-50 split, and Mike Pence had to break the tie there. So do you think there's a difference, Bill, in the way these two sets of nominees are treated? Or do you think that Biden is just saving his hardest confirmations for the last ones?
Well, it may be a little of both. But look, it's not just cabinet appointees. Compare how the Supreme Court nominees from Democratic presidents are treated to the Supreme Court nominees of Republican presidents. And you don't even have to look at just Donald Trump's nominees. You could go back to George W. Bush, George H. W. Bush, or so forth. So I think there's generally there is a difference. I also think Republicans in general share the principle that I do, that a president, I think, is presumed to have the right to pick his own cabinet, right? Barring some other issues. It's interesting to me who's being held up. Some of them, some of them, I think it's because of personal reasons, not in the sense that they're private reasons, but Neera Tandram, just the way she's treated people in the past. I think she could have the same liberal record, but if she hadn't been so abrasive to senators and so forth, she might be in a better position today. Again, it's not surprising that there are policy differences and sharp policy differences that people, people might also object to, but I think there generally has to be something else if it's going to sink a nomination, something else in addition.
Well, I agree with you, Bill, on the presumption that the president should be able to choose in broad brushstrokes the advisors that he wants around him in his cabinet. But I guess, Kim, I mean, do you have a read on whether that presumption is shared more widely on one side of the aisle than the other?
Oh, well, look, I think that it is viewed very much as standard fare among many Republicans, or at least more Republicans than not. And so that's why you get those votes that are pretty high. Whereas I remember when the Trump nominees were going through for cabinet officials, just one after the other after the other, nearly every Democrat defected. And they all said, you know, you aren't qualified, or you're too partisan, or you're too, or we just don't like your politics. Normally there's one or two over there that will come along, guys like a Joe Manchin, for instance. But I think overall, that there is that philosophy. And I think it stems from the fact that Republicans are very much into the Constitution, but that general belief that the executive branch is owed some deference on who he has around him is something that many Republicans agree with.
Now, the caveat, of course, is that we're only halfway through this process with Biden, and there may be some tighter votes ahead. And Neera Tanden, Bill, you mentioned, she's the nominee for the Office of Budget and Management. Office of Management and Budget, OMB. She's the one that Washington is most focused on. And what's the controversy here? I mean, it's essentially about tweets that she put out, right?
Right. I think that a lot of the senators believe that in sending these tweets, they were too vitriolic. They were not the kind of thing that they think is that you would expect from a cabinet secretary and so forth. That's what I mean, that I think it's not enough that there are policy differences. There are other things. Joe Manchin, a Democrat, said that he was opposing her and specifically cited this kind of toxic back and forth she's had with other senators. And I think by his doing that, I think he made it harder for Republicans, say moderate Republicans in some areas, to vote for her, because if even a Democrat is going to go against her, you know, it would seem that that makes it harder for some Republicans. You know, you mentioned the Secretary for Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas, and you know, he was held up a little bit because when he was deputy the last time, he went through a confirmation hearing when there was an inspector general investigation into the way he handled visas, investment visas. In other words, you invest a certain amount of money and you get a visa in the U.S. and the favoritism stuff. And the inspector general's report is pretty damning, but he skated through last time because the report didn't come out until he was already in there and confirmed. So those are the kind of things that when I say there has to be another factor generally for the opposition to become significant.
Yeah. And I would just add, I think one of those factors, and Bill just touched on it, is the big issue here with Neera Tanden is that she has directly attacked members of Congress. And that's the one thing you really don't want to do if you're now putting your fate in the Senate's hands, and pretty aggressively as well, too. She called, you know, Maine Senator Susan Collins, quote, the worst. She repeatedly referred to Mitch McConnell, you know, the minority leader of the Senate, as Moscow Mitch, which is really, I mean, really something, because you are essentially claiming in a tweet online that the leader of the Republican Party is somehow a tool of the Russian government, which is just beyond the pale. And she once also said that, you know, vampires have more heart than Ted Cruz. So, you know, it's one thing to have the argument that presidents are owed deference and should have people around them. It's another for senators to sit back and say, we're going to support somebody who is actively hostile to members of the very Senate now confirming it.
And that's essentially what Joe Manchin said in his statement. I mean, here's what he said. He said, I believe her overtly partisan statements will have a toxic and detrimental impact on the important working relationship between members of Congress and the next director of the Office of Management and Budget. And so, Bill, I mean, one side of this argument is that it's not fair to judge a nominee based on essentially some mean tweets. But the other side of the argument, I guess, is, you know, be careful who you savage on Twitter. It's actually real life. This stuff exists out in the world. And Tanden has deleted now something like 1,000 tweets that she sent previously.
Yeah, that latter sort of speaks to what she's worried about. You know, I think they've caught her red-handed. There's no doubt that she said or did these things, very intemperate. There are no hard and fast rules. As I say, the idea that a president deserves his nominees is a presumption. There's nothing that says they have to do it, you know, in the advise and consent. So they can kind of do whatever they want. But I think even the senators realize if they overdo it, you know, if they just reject people willy-nilly or just because they disagree with the policy, then we're not going to be able to run anything. So this is kind of an in the middle position. You know, yes, you have the presumption, but, you know, sometimes you put up someone that's very dubious in their professionalism, how they comport themselves and how they deal with Congress. Congress might have something to say about that.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from The Wall Street Journal.
If only life had a remote control, you could pause or rewind. Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. Take the 1-minute risk test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its prediabetes awareness partners.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. A couple more questions on Tandon. It looks like her nomination is in some real trouble. On Wednesday morning, the committee vote on her was postponed. So we'll have to see where that goes. But Kim, how do you break down the strategies here? I mean, is this an opportunity for Joe Manchin to signal he's a moderate by voting against somebody in the cabinet without stopping any substantive part of Biden's agenda? Is this, the Republican chance to torpedo one of Biden's nominees? Is this not Biden putting forth someone who is progressive so he can say he did that? He can walk away if it doesn't work out.
In this case with Joe Manchin, look, I do think that you're going to see a lot of strategizing from Joe Manchin in coming months. He holds an incredibly powerful position now, being the 50th vote potentially on anything. He's not alone. Kyrsten Sinema as well, from Arizona. Both of them tend to describe themselves as moderates. And so they're going to have the ability to derail things if they want or demand significant changes. But in this particular case of Neera Tanden, I don't necessarily think that this is strategizing. I do actually think that this is a personal issue for Joe Manchin, in that he has very deep working relationships with some moderate Republican members, including people like Susan Collins. They're very close. And I have no doubt that this is sort of his statement that he did not like or appreciate Tandon's behavior and her comments and attacks on a Republican that he works with. So I do actually think there's that element of Joe Manchin, and I think that's the part of Joe Manchin that is talking with his decision to say no here.
A couple of other cabinet nominees that are stirring up some controversy, Bill. Let's start with the Health and Human Services Secretary nomination. Javier Becerra, the Attorney General of California, who is facing the Senate here. What's the criticism of him?
Well, there's different criticisms of him. I, for one, would be firmly on the opposite side of most of his healthcare policies, right? He's very progressive, has a progressive past, has a very definite agenda on healthcare. That, again, to me, is a policy difference. One of the things that does give me pause, one of the criticisms of him, and his work back in his home state, California, is that, for example, he went after the Little Sisters of the Poor. Now, also, I'd have to remember the timing on him. He went after them after they'd already been taken to the Supreme Court. And I think there's an element of really bad faith there to keep harassing these nuns in an effort to force them to provide contraception. So we'll see. I think that in many places he's a lightning rod. I'm not sure it's going to be enough to sink him. And a lot of the policy criticisms, I would just take that as a given. You know, Joe Biden has a very definite health policy, and Becerra shares a lot of that. But again, a lot of people are looking at his actions as Attorney General in California, and again, especially on religion and some of these issues where the states have really been smacked down by, I think, both the Supreme Court and Bill Barr when he was Attorney General. So we'll see if that's enough to bring him down. But he's certainly become a lightning rod for a lot of groups. There are a lot of conservative groups running ads against him now.
The other nominee I had in mind is the Interior Secretary choice, Deb Haaland. And Kim, what's the story there? And is there anything there that might convince Joe Manchin to come out against?
Well, she had her hearing, but I think the issue here is she's just so out of the mainstream. I don't know how you could call her anything but a fairly radical nomination. She's currently the representative for the 1st District of New Mexico. She's been doing that for a term. But she's, and people are kind of raving about the fact that she would be the first Native American to serve in cabinet and to oversee the Interior Department's Bureau of Indian Affairs. I think the problem, though, is that, you know, the Bureau of Indian Affairs is certainly an important position within the Interior, but that's just one piece of what Interior does. This is an agency that oversees one-fifth of all the land of the United States, all of its offshore, 400 national parks, fish and game policy, the Bureau of Land Management, and all the agencies that govern federal energy development. And, you know, in the past, every Interior nominee has kind of taken the position that Interior's department mission is to balance natural resources for the benefit and enjoyment of the people, that famous phrase. This would be the first Interior nominee who is totally opposed to fracking and drilling on all public land. This is a nominee who is in favor and is a co-sponsor of the Green New Deal. And this is a nominee who, you know, back in 2016, she actually joined the protesters at the Dakota Access Pipeline. You know, and this was a really raucous affair. People threw stones and Molotov cocktails at cops and set fire to things. So, you know, and she was asked about it at her hearing, and she just kind of brushed it off and wouldn't also say how she felt about pipelines. So a person just totally opposed to a major portion of Interior Department's stuff, work that it does. Now, she had her hearing in front of Joe Manchin. Joe Manchin put out a kind of happy email afterwards saying that he was happy that she had promised to work with him. That suggests to me that in that case, to go to your point about strategy, he's not going to use his power to derail a Biden nominee, even though this one will be opposed, I'd imagine, by nearly every Republican.
That's interesting, though, because, your characterization is right. And just so people know, I mean, this is a quote from Holland in a 2019 interview with The Guardian. She said, quote, "I'm wholeheartedly against fracking and drilling on public lands," unquote. And Bill, if I were trying to come up with some kind of a bat signal for Joe Manchin to get him to come come out in opposition to something, it would look something like that.
Yes, it would. That's why we'll see if that shakes it up. I think, look, to put it in perspective, Joe Biden is not the first president to have his nominees tested and to lose some nominees. I mean, Donald Trump, I think, lost about four or five nominees, including Andrew Posner. I think it was a very qualified man, and so forth. John Ratcliffe. So a couple of people that always happens in things. Barack Obama lost Tom Daschle, Bill Richardson, and Judge Gregory withdrew his name as Secretary of Commerce. So it's common to have it, and everyone says what went wrong. But sometimes the Senate just says no, this is too far. And Joe Biden's going through it now. We'll see. He is a lot of these nominees, I think, have more of a progressive past than some of the ones we've got through in the beginning. So they may be the more, you know, hot button nominees, as you kind of suggested at the outset. And we'll see if they squeak through. You know, he also, I mean, the other factor is that this is an incredibly tight Senate, 50-50. So almost anyone can upset the apple cart. If one goes to the other side, then you have to get one back just to be back at the tie. So it's going to be tight in some of these cases. I think most of them will probably squeak through. It might be very, very tight, but it's going to be close.
Finally, on Monday, the Supreme Court declined to take a case from Pennsylvania involving the election rules there. And we've talked about that case some in previous podcasts. But essentially, the ballot deadline for mail ballots, according to the law, is 8 p.m. on Election Day. And the state Supreme Court moved that back and said, you know, ballots that come in 3 days late will be valid, even if they are missing postmarks. If you can't read the postmark, you'll presume that it was mailed on time unless there's evidence to the contrary. I mean, the election now is over. There was nothing in this case, Kim, that would have changed any of the results. But to me, this looks like a missed opportunity for the court to clean up, clear up an open question in the law.
Absolutely. And to quote Justice Clarence Thomas, who dissented, he and three people dissented with the decision not to take this up. You know, the decision to just let this stand is baffling. You know, you have an opportunity here to make clear that the rules of the game are the rules of the game, and that either unelected officials or whomever cannot just go partway through and decide that they're going to change them in a way that could potentially be more advantageous to one political party over the other. And indeed, one of the other justices who dissented with this, Justice Alito, noted that it would be really surprising if in future parties who are unhappy with the current rules don't look at this decision and ask state courts to substitute ones that they like more. So, that we're already bearing down on the next midterm election. And it's really unfortunate the Supreme Court didn't use this moment to clean this up.
And the other side of this legal argument is there are those who say that state courts are have the final word on matters of state law. Federal courts shouldn't be looking over their shoulder on these election issues. And when state legislatures pass an election code, that's not exempt from state court review, Bill. But what the three dissenters here said essentially was, it gets to a point where the law says the deadline is 8 p.m. There's no way that a state court should be able to look at that and say the deadline is not 8 p.m.
Right. I mean, I think that's the crux of it. Look, the states are entitled to, you know, pass their election laws and so forth and set it. But they have to, I think the argument for the Supreme Court to come in is that they have to play by their own rules. And in acting for the courts here, letting the courts overturn that, you are effectively letting the courts set the rules, right? Rather than the elected representatives. That's what I find so egregious about the decision. And I would go further than Kim. She said it's an opportunity for the Supreme Court. I actually think it's closer to an obligation. I mean, the integrity, we've heard so much about the integrity of our elections. And if we're going to make last minute court-appointed adjustments to the election laws, no one's going to have any confidence in it. This was really, this to me was really an act of cowardice by the Supreme Court not to take this up.
And I mean, I think it strikes me that Alito was right here, that that this will encourage more examples of people going to state courts and saying that what's in the election code is not fair and trying to get some more advantageous rules, but also just rules that create unanticipated problems. And there's some data on what actually happened in Pennsylvania in the journal's editorial on this. In the end, there were 10,097 ballots that showed up 3 days late on time under the extended deadline. But 669 of those, Kim, lacked legible postmarks. There was either no postmark or there was a postmark and it could not be read. And that strikes me as a real problem. If a court is going to say late ballots have to be accepted, and the postmark failure rate is something like 7%. I mean, who knows how representative that is, but 7%, I mean, that's a real problem.
Well, it's a real problem because we increasingly have these very tight elections, right? So I think what you're saying correctly is that you got the Supreme Court of a state making a decision, or any court in a state making a decision that essentially is going to call an election one way or the other. And that's what the justices were alluding to, Alito in particular, saying, look, we all know that there's all kinds of ways that you can, you know, fiddle with the rules here and there, and it's going to help one side over the other. And do we really want to be using courts in that way? And just one last thing to Bill's point, and I agree, actually, Bill, I think it was an obligation, not just an opportunity. But, you know, all of this is happening even as we're having a national discussion about election rules. And even as you just had this incredible, you know, view, the Supreme Court had to have seen it too, of just what happens when people don't have confidence in the rules. So you've got all these legislatures and all these people out in the states trying to think about ways to restore confidence. Here was the Supreme Court getting served its opportunity or its, you know, need to sort of come out there and just play its own part in this, and it completely whiffed.
So what happened then, Bill? I mean, in an earlier stage of the case, the Pennsylvania Republican Party, I think the House or the Senate there, asked the Supreme Court to stay the Pennsylvania Supreme Court's ruling. And there were four votes to do that. The court split evenly 4-4 after the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And it, now it takes four votes to take the case, and those four votes aren't there. I mean, I do think that the claims that Trump, President Trump, made about the election and the riot in the Capitol on January 6th have maybe made this issue more electrified than it needed to be. I mean, do you think that's what happened? I mean, the justices are just saying, we'll deal with this in a different case that does not involve Donald Trump.
I hope that's not the reason, because we're supposed to have the law is supposed to be the same, whether it's for Donald Trump or Joe Biden or Kyle Peterson or Bill McGurn. I think some of them, not all, and there are obviously three votes for taking the case, are just afraid, because you know that if they ruled the way I believe they ought to have ruled, that Pennsylvania has to obey its own laws and what the court did was not proper. It would be a firestorm, and they would be accused of being pro-Trump and everything. But I think, as Clarence Thomas said, I believe it was last summer, or the summer before, on another case that they passed up, the reason the Supreme Court is given lifetime tenure is so that they won't be afraid to do their jobs and take these cases. It's to me, it's very dispiriting, because you hope, you understand politicians and partisans getting involved and getting all heated and emotional. And, you know, the hope is that the Supreme Court can step back and look at this objectively and rule accordingly. And now it looks like, you know, if the court is afraid, that's a very bad message, too.
Thank you, Kim and Bill. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back later this week with another edition of Potomac Watch.